They called it a hate crime, then a terror plot, then a lone wolf attack. But I knew the shooter. I knew the way he spoke, the way he held his tea, the way he watched me like I was both the question and the answer. He didn't need to radicalize me. He made me fall in love with him. By the time the bullets flew, I wasn't just a witness. I was part of the story, his story. This isn't about justice, or revenge, or guilt. This is about what happens when you realize you were never the victim. You were the weapon. This is my story, the one they tried to bury. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The mall smelled like cinnamon and regret. That morning, I had walked in with a simple plan. Grab a black coffee, avoid my ex, and disappear into the quiet hum of early shoppers. But he found me first. His name wasn't on any security logs. He wore no name badge, carried no bag. But he stared like he'd known me my whole life. Middle Eastern, I think. Soft voice. The kind of voice that doesn't match the chaos it eventually unleashes. "Do you believe in second chances?" he asked. I laughed then. But now, I can still hear those words echoing behind every gunshot. He introduced himself as Amir. But that wasn't his real name. I'd find that out later. He said he was studying immigration law. Said he cared about people. Said I reminded him of someone. He never touched me. Never flirted. But he followed me. At first, it felt like fate. Like someone finally saw through the layers of numbness I carried. But manipulation doesn't always start with seduction. Sometimes it starts with kindness. The weeks blurred. He'd wait outside the bookstore where I worked. Not every day, just enough to feel unplanned. He brought me chai tea once. Said it was a traditional recipe. I tasted ginger and something I still can't name. He never talked about politics, but he asked about fear. "Do you ever think someone could make you do something you'd never imagine?" At the time, I thought he meant love. 3 days before the shooting, he disappeared. No goodbye. No calls. His number disconnected. I thought he ghosted me. But when the bullets rang out and people screamed, when I hid behind a perfume kiosk and saw him calmly reloading, I realized. He never left me. He just left the version of himself I had fallen for. They called it a hate crime, then a terror plot, then a lone wolf. But I know better. Because the truth they don't want you to know? Amir loved me, and he told me everything he was planning, without ever saying a word. I didn't leave the house for 5 days after the attack. Not because I was traumatized, though I was, but because I didn't know if I had been a victim or an accomplice. They kept showing his face on the news. The media had found grainy footage from a traffic cam, his body outlined in red, zoomed in like some monster from a true crime documentary. The Boulder Mall shooter, they called him. But I didn't see a killer. I saw the man who once cried telling me about the war he left behind. I saw the man who left a handwritten quote from Rumi on my windshield. "The wound is the place where the light enters you." I kept that note. Still have it. The ink is faded now, almost pink. He wrote it in red gel pen like a schoolboy. Folded it carefully twice, no smudges. There were more, too, slipped between pages of books I'd lent him. Hidden in the hem of my coat. "In one," he said, "there are people who will rewrite your life without ever touching a pen." I thought he meant my ex. I thought Amir had come to rescue me. I didn't realize he was the author. The FBI showed up on the sixth day. Two men in dark suits, bland faces, no names. They asked if I knew him. I lied. And that was the first manipulation I ever performed. Not for love. Not for him. But because deep down, I needed to believe it had all been a mistake. That I hadn't been groomed. That I hadn't helped a killer blend in. But memory has its own way of punishing you. That night, I dreamed of his eyes, those quiet, sorrowful things. In the dream, he was sitting on my bed, whispering lullabies in a language I couldn't understand. When I woke up, there was a flash drive on my nightstand. Still warm, like someone had just placed it there. The folder on the drive was named False Flag, True Love. Inside, videos. Dozens of them. Amir. In a room I didn't recognize. Talking to someone off camera. Explaining me. "She's useful. She moves invisible. They'll never suspect her." One clip cut to his face in shadow. He whispered, "No one believes in true flags anymore. You have to raise the wrong one to get anyone to look up." He had been documenting everything, every encounter, every word I said, every glance I gave him. And still, I wanted to believe it was love. Because if it wasn't, then I was just a pawn who thought she was queen. There was one final clip, the only one that felt unscripted. He looked right into the lens, eyes tired, voice low. He said, "If you're watching this, it means I succeeded. But I didn't do it for politics. I did it for her. I wanted the world to know what happens when someone disappears you." That night, I deleted everything. Then threw the flash drive into the river. But it was already too late, because a new message had arrived in my inbox. No sender, just one sentence. "You were never the victim. You were the weapon." I started watching myself differently after that message. Every reflection felt foreign, like someone had slipped a stranger into my skin. I checked the mirror for signs of betrayal. Who had I been to him? What did he see in me that I didn't see in myself? And more terrifying, what had I unknowingly passed on? The police had been wrong about everything. It wasn't about ideology. It wasn't about hate. It was intimacy as infiltration. Amir hadn't needed explosives. He didn't need blueprints. He had me. My job at the bookstore. My routine coffee shop visits. My offhand comments about mall security blind spots. He harvested my life like a database of trust. I remembered once telling him how the mall's northeast wing had motion sensors that lagged a few seconds during power surges. It was just a random anecdote. But that was exactly where he fired first. I didn't want to go back there. But I had to. Not for justice. For answers. The place was sealed off with police tape. The scent of smoke and scorched metal lingered, even weeks later. In the rubble of what used to be the shoe store, I found a melted keyring. My keyring. One I thought I had lost. Had he taken it? Or had I given it to him? That night, I returned to his favorite coffee shop. It had closed down fast. The owner said the FBI swept through days ago. They'd left something behind. A forgotten sketchbook buried under the cushions of the corner booth. It was Amir's. He had drawn me over and over. Different angles. Different moods. Each sketch more intimate than the last. One showed me asleep, clutching my coat. Another showed me crying in the storage room of the bookstore, the tears drawn in smudged graphite. And then the last page. "She will awaken when the lie becomes her own." I ran. Not from the scene. From the realization. Amir hadn't made me part of his plan. He had made me believe in it. What no one tells you is that manipulation doesn't always feel like a trick. Sometimes it feels like freedom. Like someone seeing the parts of you even you've abandoned. Like purpose. And in Amir's arms, I felt purposeful for the first time in years. Even if that purpose was to be used. I thought of the message again. "You were never the victim. You were the weapon." What if they were right? What if I'd always been waiting for someone to pull my trigger? I stopped saying his name. Not because I forgot it. No, I remembered every syllable, every vowel like it was tattooed on the back of my teeth. I stopped because the name felt like a door, and every time I said it, something in me opened I couldn't close again. But the world wouldn't stop whispering it. A podcast had surfaced. False flag or federal setup? 3 million downloads in a week. They dissected the Boulder Mall shooting like it was entertainment. One host claimed Amir was an FBI asset. Another insisted he had been created, radicalized not by faith, but by design. But no one mentioned me. Not once. That's how I knew someone was working overtime to erase me. It made sense. A bookstore clerk who suddenly disappears after the attack? Who had been seen walking with the suspect just days prior? Who knew the exact location of a blind spot in mall security? Someone should have been asking questions. But instead, they deleted the questions altogether. I tried to log in to my work email. Deactivated. My name gone from the employee roster. My lease. Terminated. Even my old voicemail, blank. No greeting. No number. It was like someone had erased me. That night, I sat in my dark apartment, watching my own security footage. I had installed the cameras myself, back when I was still afraid of break-ins, not breakdowns. And there it was. Frame by frame. Two men entering my apartment. Wearing black. Carrying no tools. No weapons. Just a laptop. They didn't steal anything. They just connected something. Downloaded something. Wiped something. And left. I wasn't just the weapon. I was evidence. The kind of evidence they couldn't let exist. So I ran. Not to a friend. Not to family. I had none left. I ran to the only place that hadn't yet rejected me, my childhood home. It was abandoned. Shattered windows. Mold on the ceiling. But the attic still held my old notebooks. And in one of them, tucked into the binding, was a list Amir once made. Names. Locations. Dates. And next to mine a red X. Every name had an X. Except one. Nadia Santiago. I didn't know who she was. But the note beneath said, If she lives, the truth lives. Protect her. And just like that, I had a new purpose. Not survival. Reversal. Because if I had been the weapon, then maybe, just maybe, I could become the cure. I didn't trust GPS anymore. Not since I learned that Amir had been tracking me through a dating app he never downloaded. So I found Nadia Santiago the old-fashioned way. Public library. Microfilm. Local archives. She wasn't on social media. No digital trail. But in a small-town newspaper from 5 years ago, barely legible in smeared ink, I found her name. College student survives botched federal raid. No follow-up article. No interviews. No photos. Just her name and one quote. They said I was part of something. But I was just trying to go home. Nadia lived two states away, near a dry basin town forgotten by time. I rented a car in someone else's name. Paid cash. Taped over the dashboard cam with chewing gum. I didn't know what I'd say to her. All I knew was that Amir had marked her as the only one worth protecting. Her house was nothing like I expected. A mobile home parked on gravel. Overgrown weeds. Two wind chimes shaped like angel wings. She answered before I knocked. Like she'd been waiting. She looked older than her age. Like life had pressed on her bones harder than most. And her first words weren't a greeting. They were a warning. If you found me, they'll find you too. I told her everything. Not because I trusted her, but because I needed someone to say it to out loud. All of it. The bookstore, the love notes, the sketches, the flash drive, the message in my inbox. Nadia didn't flinch. She just nodded, then walked to her closet and pulled out a locked box. Inside, a burner phone, 5 SIM cards, and a set of blueprints. Not of the mall. Of me. They've done this before, she said. Not just to you. Not just to me. They recruit people who've already disappeared emotionally. Trauma survivors. Quiet women. Ones no one would believe. They make us feel seen, then they load the gun. Amir had been one of them. But not always. According to Nadia, he was part of a behavioral engineering program run under the guise of immigration reform. Some knew it as Project Glass Dove. A ghost file, off the books, funded by backdoor deals between private surveillance firms and a federal counterintelligence agency. Their goal? False flag emotional weapons. People who would never appear suspicious. Until they were activated. I asked why she was still alive. She said it was because she hadn't been useful yet. But now that I had come to her, now that our stories aligned, she was a liability. We both were. That night, we heard the first drone. Not military, private. Silent. Hovering. Nadia grabbed her backpack. No hesitation. If they've deployed eyes, the hands are coming next. We ran. Not from the lies. From the cleanup team. Because people like us? We aren't meant to survive the narrative. But here's the thing no one told them. When you program someone to be a weapon, you better hope they never wake up. We drove through the night, headlights off. Nadia navigated by memory, not map. She said GPS could be spoofed now. Your car could be tricked into thinking it was in Alaska when it was really 2 blocks from a kill team. I believed her. Because nothing about my old life made sense anymore. The mall. Amir. The flash drive. Even my own face in the mirror looked like evidence. By morning, we arrived at a safe house buried in pine. It belonged to a man Nadia only called the cartographer. A former drone analyst turned whistleblower. He was gaunt, jittery, smelled like cigarettes and clay. But when he spread those blueprints across the table, I stopped breathing. They weren't just of buildings. They were of people. Each file had a code name. Not just mine, dozens of them. Glassdove 12B. Female 27. History of trauma. Abandonment tendency. Empathic susceptibility score. 8.9/10. That was me. The program doesn't choose extremists, he explained. It builds them. The cartographer had mapped the profiles of over 50 unwitting assets used in domestic psychological experiments. Some were triggered for media manipulation. Some, for more lethal ends. Amir was listed as Shepherd class, meaning he wasn't just a subject. He was a handler. My handler. I remembered every conversation we ever had. How he never told me what to do. Just asked questions. Gave me things to think about. Like, if you could make one person pay for your pain, who would it be? At the time, I said, myself. He didn't even blink. Just replied, that's a dangerous answer. But a useful one. Now I understood. Amir didn't radicalize me. He reshaped my pain into a direction. He didn't need a bomb. I was already carrying one. Nadia and I stayed in the safe house for 2 days. The cartographer showed us everything. Deleted footage, altered newsreels, court documents that had been reclassified mid-trial. Project Glass Dove had already been buried twice in Senate hearings, and every time they renamed it. Paper Halo, Crimson Quiet, White Room Syndrome. We debated going public, but Nadia said something I still think about every night. They don't kill people anymore. They erase them. Your face will still be on camera, your voice still on the phone, but the real you? Gone. That night, someone knocked on the safe house door. Three knocks. Silence. Three more. A pattern from one of Amir's notes. I opened it. No one was there. Just a USB drive and a printed Polaroid. Amir, standing in front of a new location. Smiling. Alive. He had faked his death. And if that was true, then the story we were telling ourselves, about escape, about exposure, wasn't the ending. It was bait. The Polaroid haunted me. Amir, smiling like he'd won. Like this was all a game of chess and we were already four moves too late. His eyes calm. The background, a rooftop city skyline blurred behind him. A visible logo behind his shoulder, Orion Systems. Nadia turned white when she saw it. That's a shell company. Private security contractor. They used to train foreign interrogators. Now they build AI for crowd control. I asked what it meant. She didn't answer. She just started packing. The USB drive contained one file. No encryption. Just A.Wave audio. I almost didn't press play. But then I heard his voice. Smooth. Gentle. The same voice that once asked if I liked cinnamon in my tea. I hope you found the cartographer. I hope you found each other. That's what this was really about. Not justice. Connection. Nadia played it twice. Then she snapped the USB in half and threw it in the fireplace. He's not trying to warn us, she whispered. He's trying to trigger us. Because every breadcrumb we'd followed, every reveal, every truth, was placed. Carefully. And that's when we realized. We were still in the program. Not as assets. As subjects of phase two. They're measuring us, Nadia said. How far we'll run. How long we'll dig. How deeply we'll bond. They're studying grief in real time. She was right. We weren't the ones escaping. We were the ones being watched. I went outside to scream. To cry. To feel anything but manipulated. That's when I saw it. Another drone. But not overhead. Stationary. Parked on the gravel driveway. Half buried in the frost. Nadia ran over. Not military issue. Not private contractor. It was ours. It's been recording everything, she said. They didn't even hide it. Because they knew we'd find it. Inside the drone's hard drive were hours of footage. Me. Sleeping. Nadia. Arguing. The cartographer. Erasing maps and redrawing them with shaky hands. Every word we'd said. Every truth we thought we'd found. All of it. Logged, timestamped, uploaded. There was even footage of me finding the Polaroid. Except, in that clip I wasn't alone. A man stood just out of frame, face obscured, holding something. When he turned slightly, I saw the scar on his wrist. It was Amir. He hadn't just faked his death. He was operating phase two. The test wasn't over. It had just begun. We had two choices. Run again, or confront the truth, on our own terms. Nadia chose confrontation. I wasn't ready, but I followed her anyway. Because fear, I'd learned, wasn't the absence of control. It was the realization you never had it. We left the safe house in silence. She took us to a storage unit two towns away. Inside was a black box labeled simply, Failsafe. It contained burner phones, counterfeit IDs, and a map. Hand-drawn. Folded 10 times. At the center, Orion Systems headquarters. Not a real company. Not anymore. Now just a cover for a rotating shadow operation where Amir had last been seen. We end it there, Nadia said. Not for justice. Not for exposure. For the chance to tell our own version. Before they erase us completely. I didn't ask how she planned to do it. Because I was already planning my own version. We arrived at nightfall. The building sat like a glass coffin in the middle of the industrial district. Faceless, soundless, gleaming with invisible guilt. We entered through the loading dock. No alarms. No resistance. Which meant they wanted us there. The first room was empty. Then the second. Then suddenly motion lights. A single chair. A table. And a file folder labeled. Subject 12B. Me. Inside surveillance stills. Medical scans. Psychological assessments. Every conversation I had with Amir. Every breakdown I'd had in childhood. Every panic attack. Every therapy session. All recorded. On the back page, a photo. Me. But not from the past. From 5 minutes ago. I turned, heart freezing. Amir stood in the doorway. He didn't speak right away. He just looked tired. "You were never the subject," he said. "You were the mirror. A test for them. To see if they could love what they destroyed." Nadia stepped between us. Gun drawn. "You don't get to rewrite the story again." But Amir didn't flinch. He reached into his pocket, slowly, and placed a phone on the table. "Unlocked. Live stream recording. Us. It's already uploading," he whispered. "To everyone. All the footage. All the files. All the lies. Your whole truth." Then he turned to me. "You always had the trigger. You just didn't know where to aim." Nadia didn't shoot. Neither did I. Because in that moment I understood. Amir wasn't trying to survive. He was trying to surrender, to me. Because I was the last test. Would I continue the cycle? Would I destroy him to reclaim myself? Or would I finally break free? I took the phone, deleted the stream, then dropped it on the ground, and walked away. The next morning, Amir was gone. So was Nadia. The building had been wiped. No trace left of our names, our presence, or the truth. But I didn't need evidence anymore. Because for the first time in years, I wasn't a victim. I wasn't a weapon. I was the author.